This is the first day of this October 2016 seven-day session. And we're going to read from a the favorite texts of mine as well as Roshi Kaplow's, a book called Zen Dawn, which is the collection of the earliest Zen texts. And these come from the Dunhuang Caves in the edge of the Gobi Desert. And it's translated by J.C. Cleary. I see from my notes that the last time I read from this this first half of this book was about 6 years ago, so some of it will be new even to people who have heard it before. It begins with the introduction by saying that the three meditation manuals translated in this volume are among the earliest surviving records of Zen Buddhism in China. Zen, of course, in China is called Chan. These texts had disappeared for many centuries in China, and they were rediscovered in just the 20th century, the early 20th century, by a British architect by the name of Orrell Stein, who made a caravan across the along the Silk Road, and was told by a monk about these great treasures that were buried in caves in these Dunhuang caves. It's kind of an oasis. There's a stream that runs alongside these caves. And then he set about plundering the caves and sending back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of the original sutras from the 8th century. He's been fiercely criticized, especially by the Chinese, for having made off with what they consider their national treasures, but people have pointed out that in doing so, he may have saved them from the ravages of the Red Guard during the revolution from 1966 to 1976, where these the Cultural Revolution and their zealousness, their political zeal, they set about to destroy temples and monks and also great records like these. I saw some of these sutras, the original sutras behind glass in the British Museum about 30 years ago when I was there. And we always think of Bodhidharma as the founder of the Chan sect, Zen sect, and we can continue to do so, because it's such a consensus that he was the first ancestor, the first patriarch of Chan. But here this book begins with another master, Gunabhadra. Remember, these are translations of the records that were dug out of those caves, records from the 8th century. And this is just the translation, the direct translation of those records, translation by J.C. Cleary. So it begins here. Gunabhadra Tripitaka was a man of South India. When he studied the great vehicle, the Mahayana, he was called Mahayana. In the period of 424 to 554, he came by ship to Guangzhou. The emperor received him, the emperor at the time. This was a Song dynasty, but the earlier Song dynasty, the one that's most famous in Zen, is the one that followed the Tang dynasty. The Song dynasty that most of the masters we read from in Taisho was started in about 1000, the late 900s, but this was an earlier one. It says here he translated the Lankavatara Sutra. This is one of the sutras most highly prized in the Zen school. And elsewhere, in other sources, we're told that this was Lankavatara Sutra was Bodhidharma's favorite sutra. Princes and nobles, monks and laymen invited him to give instructions on meditation, but Gunabhadra was embarrassed and declined because he did not speak Chinese well. That night he dreamed that a man lopped off his head with a sword. Thenceforth he began to give lessons on meditation. Gunabhadra said, "This country is located in the east." This country, of course, means China. He's from South India, same as Bodhidharma. "This country is located in the east and lacks methods of cultivating the path. Since they lack such methods, some fall into the teachings of the lesser vehicle," which would be probably referring to the Hinayana, "and the two vehicles," and there's no footnote there, so I don't know what that means. "Some fall into the teachings of the 95 kinds of outside paths. Some fall into demonic meditation in order to view all things and find out the good and bad deeds of other people." That seems to be some kind of a psychic powers to be developed, where you could read the minds of other people. And it's, as is clear here, Gunabhadra had a low regard for such using the mind in that way. Because he says, "How bitter, what a great misfortune. They entrap themselves and entrap others. I feel sorry for these types, who fall for long ages into demonic paths, subject to birth and death, and do not attain liberation." This sort of sets the tone for the view in Zen of psychic powers, paranormal powers, as something that's really beside the point of the true Buddha Dharma. These things cannot compare to seeing the illusory nature of self. Maybe there's some parallel that can be drawn between these psychic powers and the vaunted benefits of mindfulness that we see everywhere today, secular mindfulness, where it'll bring you this benefit and that benefit. It'll help you be more effective at work and increase your income and make you more successful and so forth. But the Dharma is so far beyond that. It's not developing or improving the self, as nice as that may be, but it's seeing through the self and other. seeing beyond this world of phenomena, of selves and others and uses and thems, of thingness, seeing beyond thingness, seeing beyond, through and beyond psychic powers. And higher or lower income, and greater or lesser success, seeing through it all. Meaning seeing the insubstantial nature of all of these phenomena. So again, I feel sorry for these types who fall for long ages into the demonic path, subject to birth and death, and do not attain liberation. Some fall into forbidden magical arts, controlling spirits and demons, spying on other people's good and bad deeds. They falsely say, "I sit in meditation and practice contemplation." Ordinary people are blind and deluded and do not understand and think that such magicians have indeed realized the path of the sages and submit to them. They do not know that these are perverse, demonic methods. And then, referring to India, he says, "In our land, we have the correct teaching, but it is secret and not openly transmitted. Those who have an affinity with it and whose faculties are fully prepared meet good and wise people on the road who bestow it on them. If not for encounters with good and wise teachers, there would be no transmission." This phrase, "those who have an affinity with it," is, I think, the most correct way to understand Sangha as compared to non-Sangha, is those of us in the Sangha, those of us who practice the way, have an affinity with it. We're not better or more evolved. It's simply that we have an affinity with it, whereas others do not. It's such a clean, simple, non-judgmental way to understand it. We have these introductory workshops every 6 to 8 weeks at the center, and at the end of each introductory workshop, about 4:30 in the afternoon, most of the participants usually stay to hear about membership. So they have that much interest in it. They're somewhat sold on it. But then of those participants, only a small fraction have the affinity with the Dharma to become members, and then even a smaller number continue for years as members, and of those, a smaller number get to Sesshin, and so forth. It's very mysterious. It's just fascinating. You see people at these introductory workshops who seem so keen on it. They seem sold. This is it. This is what I need. This is what I need to pursue. I'm going to change my life. And half the time we never see him again. And affinity is not a fixed matter, of course. We may have an affinity with it for a few months or a few years, and then our interest turns elsewhere. The truth is, we never know what our affinity is with anything, except in retrospect. It's really the same with marriage or any kind of partnership, even a business partnership. The fact that we enter into the partnership means there's an affinity. Of course, we wouldn't be doing it if there weren't an affinity, a pretty strong affinity. But we don't know how long that affinity will continue. Nobody knows that. So the marriage vows really are a statement of intention and an aspiration, if you will. But life can have other plans. Gunabhadra continues, quoting the Lankavatara Sutra, "The mind of the Buddhas is supreme. When the Dharma is bestowed in our teaching, where deluded states of mind do not arise, it is this." The translator, Cleary, inserted that word deluded in brackets. So let's pull it back out and say, when the Dharma is bestowed in our teaching, where states of mind do not arise, it is this. A lot of Zen practice, and this becomes especially clear in Sesshin, is just learning not to get caught in states of mind. Positive states of mind, negative states of mind, exotic, interesting, enticing states of mind. That's not our business. We're attending to that which is beyond states of mind. Mu, the breath, shikantaza. States of mind are the clouds that pass across the sky. It's the sky that is our interest in Zen practice. Well, in Sesshin, we're tested on this throughout. He continues now, Gunabhadra speaking himself, "This Dharma surpasses the three vehicles and goes beyond the 10 stages. The three vehicles are the so-called Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. Ultimately, the fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent." Let me repeat that. Ultimately, the fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent. No-minded, we nurture the spirit. Without thought, we pacify the body. Without preoccupations, we sit in purity, preserving the fundamental and returning to the real. The fundamental, the essential, the sky behind the clouds. Our Dharma is secret and silent. It is not transmitted by common fools of shallow consciousness. Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it and carry it out. This phrase, without preoccupations, we sit in purity and so forth. So many things we can get preoccupied with in Sesshin and outside Sesshin. The big ones, the ones that I hear the most about in Doksan, and remember myself most, are thoughts of self, of course, that's the big one, comparing oneself to others, or comparing oneself to what one thinks about others, how I'm doing compared to others, how others are doing, getting preoccupied with what the teacher thinks about oneself. Maybe the biggest preoccupation and the most treacherous one, because it's often difficult to notice, is the preoccupation with one's practice, quote unquote. And by that I mean thoughts about one's practice. Not just the pure engagement with the breath and with the koan, but thoughts about progress or lack of it, judgmental thoughts about one's practice, evaluations of one's practice. This can be so subtle, these concerns with the idea of my practice. So not what we're doing here, we should be doing. He continues, if you do not understand, if you are not liberated, the sixth consciousness possesses the seventh and the eighth. If you do understand, if you are liberated, the eighth consciousness is without the sixth and seventh. I always hesitate to get into these eight levels, these eight modes of consciousness, because I think it can be, people can get confused. But here we go. The sixth modes of, the first six modes of consciousness, one through six, are the five ordinary modes of sensing, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and then the sixth is thinking. And the seventh is the seat of this illusory self, the ego, and the eighth is this alaya vijnana, this storehouse consciousness. So just to quickly here convert what he's saying, if you do not understand, if you are not liberated, the sixth consciousness, that is our thinking mind, possesses the seventh, so it nourishes our sense of self, a separate self, and the eighth, and it stains the eighth. It by nourishing our ego self, contaminates the inherent purity of this storehouse consciousness. But then he says, if you do understand, if you are liberated, the eighth consciousness, this Buddha mind consciousness, is without this the sixth and seventh. That is without attachment to the thinking mind and the sense of a separate self that is supported by it. This is just basic central Buddhist psychology, these eight modes of consciousness. Nothing that that we have to think about during sesshin or during practice. Then he says, those who intend to be Buddhas, which mean intend to function out of one's Buddha nature, those who intend to be Buddhas should first learn to pacify mind. Before mind is pacified, even good things are not good. So much the worse for evil. when mind becomes peaceful and still, neither good nor evil has any basis. The Huayan Sutra says, phenomena do not see each other, phenomena do not know each other. This word pacify always makes me cringe a little bit. It sounds passive. It sounds limp or something. What sounds a little better is to quiet the mind. Those who intend to be Buddhists should first learn to quiet or still the mind. Before mind is still, even good things are not good. This quote from the Huayan Sutra, phenomena do not see each other, phenomena do not know each other. In other words, there's no agency, there's nobody to see and nobody to know phenomena. And because there's no seeing and no knowing within phenomena, they can't see each other or know each other. He says, since coming to this country, to China, I have not even seen people who cultivate the path, much less anyone who has pacified mind. I often see people who go along creating karma, who have not merged with the path. Some are concerned with fame and reputation. Some act for the sake of profit and support. They operate with a mentality of self and other. They act with the attitude of jealousy. What is jealousy? It means to engender the mentality of resentment and hatred when you see someone else cultivating the path and reaching consummation in principle and practice, so that many people offer support and give their allegiance. It means self-satisfied reliance on your own intelligence, not using it to overcome self. This is called jealousy. The old records say that the Bodhidharma, who was seen as such a revolutionary, provoked jealousy in the established Buddhist church of his day, and that he died by having been poisoned by jealous monks. Who can know for sure about something that is 1,500 years ago? Even if you scrupulously perform various practices day and night, cut off afflictions and clear away obstructions, with this kind of attitude, that is of jealousy, barriers to the path arise one after another, and you do not find peace and stillness. This is just called cultivating the path. It is not called pacifying mind. Here, the way the Gunabhadra is using the phrase cultivating the path, perhaps we could liken it to sitting, but sitting with a mind full of thoughts. It's not pacifying the mind, not stilling the mind. Cultivating the path could mean other kinds of Buddhist practices, methods. But pacifying mind is what we know. It's sitting beyond thought, not engaging with thoughts. This is far more difficult than just assuming a sitting posture, even a good sitting posture, while still trafficking in thoughts. Coming to Sashin is so sobering, because inevitably, as the days pass, we come to notice what we didn't notice before. What we don't usually notice in our daily practice is how much of the time we're dwelling in our thoughts. Most of that time, most people are not aware of it. They pull their leg up, take their posture, sit straight, and still dwell in thoughts. And we come to see how difficult it is to detach from the stream of thoughts that is running through the mind all the time. It takes commitment, it takes dedication, it takes persistence. It just takes a lot of sitting to learn to notice when we're dwelling in our thoughts. He continues talking about other ways of cultivating the path. Even if you practice the six paramitas, expound the sutras, sit in meditation, and advance energetically practicing austerities, this is just called being good. It is not called Dharma practice. The six paramitas, even I can't always remember all six of them, so I'm guessing a lot of other people can't remember the six. So here's a reminder. The first of the six, the paramitas means perfections. These are the qualities that are developed through practice and that enable us to further develop our practice. They're both cause and effect of a mature practice, these six paramitas. The first is called dana, or giving, generosity. The second is morality, upholding the precepts. The third is patience or forbearance. The fourth is sometimes called effort or zeal or energetic application. The fifth is meditation. And the sixth is wisdom. So he says again, even if you practice these six and expound the sutras and put a lot of time in sitting and practice austerities, these are all just do-gooding, doing good. It's not the true thing, the Dharma. Then he says, if you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire, this is called Dharma practice. If you do not plant the seeds of consciousness there, this is called Dharma practice. So you notice here, as far as what our aspiration is, he puts it in the negative. If you do not irrigate the karmic field with desire, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness, this is called Dharma practice. So it's refraining from perpetuating our bondage to our karmic habits. And how do we refrain from irrigating the karmic field with the water of desire? How do we refrain from not from planting the seeds of consciousness? Through this no-mindedness, not trafficking in thoughts. He continues, just now I spoke of pacifying mind. In brief, there are four kinds of mentality. First, the mentality that turns away from truth. This is the mentality of those who go through life as ordinary people. Second, the mentality that turns toward truth. This means loathing birth and death and so seeking nirvana and going toward stillness. It is called the Shravaka mentality. Third, the mind that enters truth. Though you cut off barriers to the path and reveal inner truth, subject and object are not yet nullified. This is the Bodhisattva mentality. And fourth, the mind of truth. Not mind outside truth, not truth outside mind. Truth is mind. Mind is able to be everywhere equal, so it is called truth. This is harmonizing our essential nature. This is actualizing our essential nature, coming into accord with this original mind. He says, he continues, truth's awareness can illuminate everything, so it is called mind. Mind and truth are everywhere equal, so it is called Buddha mind, the mind of enlightenment. So these four very broad distinctions of stages of evolution, really. The first being just the ordinary person who knows nothing about the way, the Tao. And the second are those who are seeking it. The third is seeing into this self nature, and the fourth is the realm, I guess, of the Buddha realm of realizing it, making real this Buddha mind. Those who understand reality do not see any difference between birth and death and nirvana. These are the polar opposites that we often hear framed this way in Buddhist teaching. The world of birth and death, that is the world of phenomena, of samsara, coming and going, success and failure, being born and dying, there's that, and there's the world of nirvana. And he's saying, as so many before and after him have said, those who understand the truth do not see any difference between this world of birth and death and the world of nirvana, or between ordinary and holy. Objects and knowledge are not two. Inner truth and phenomena are fused. Real and conventional are viewed as equal. Defilement and purity are one suchness. Buddhas and sentient beings are fundamentally equal and at one. Sentient beings, remember, is the term used in certainly Chinese Buddhism and often other Buddhism. Sentient beings means the so-called unenlightened. Buddhas and sentient beings are fundamentally equal and at one. I remember hearing this my early years of practice and understanding it conceptually. Okay, fundamentally, the enlightened and the unenlightened are not two. There is only this enlightened nature. But realizing that is entirely different. Hopefully, by the end of the sesshin, there is at least one person who has confirmed that the enlightened and the unenlightened, Buddhas and sentient beings, are fundamentally equal and at one. Sometimes people ask, usually at a workshop, what does it mean to be enlightened? To have come to awakening. And I think one of the best ways of saying it is you awaken to the fact that we are all equally endowed with this enlightened nature. Equally. Absolutely. Equally. There's nothing that enlightenment gives us that we didn't have before. It's a perceptual thing. It's a perceiving. It's a seeing that's the way things are and have always been. He says, the great path is fundamentally omnipresent, perfectly pure, and basically existent. Basically existent. It is not attained from causes. So on the level of causality, that something, there's a before and there's an after. There's a previous cause and a subsequent effect. But this is something entirely beyond that. It is not attained from causes. How can it be if this enlightened nature of ours is beyond before and after, beyond time, beyond attaining or not attaining? It is like the sun hidden behind floating clouds. When the clouds are gone, the sun appears by itself. What's the use of any more learning or views? Why become involved in written or spoken words and come back again to the path of birth and death? Those who take verbal explanations and literary accounts as the path covet fame and profit. They ruin themselves and ruin others. It is like polishing a mirror. When the dust on the surface has been totally removed, the mirror of itself is bright and clear. So we don't need to make mirrors. There is just this mirror, mirror mind. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions, I vow to uproot Dharma gains beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gains beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gains beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.